Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week we speak with an expert on two nations, Bahrain and Syria. In one, the United States, in cooperation with Saudi Arabia, supports and arms a brutal dictatorship against a nonviolent popular movement for human rights. In the other, the United States supports violent opposition against the current government in the name of human rights. In neither case are these approaches driven by a higher purpose or necessitated by factors beyond U.S. control. In both cases, alternatives have been and are available. And in both cases, the actual motivations are not exactly what the U.S. government and its friendly media maintain. And a little history helps to enlighten our understanding. This is David Swanson with Talk Nation Radio. I'm delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, Reese Ehrlich. Reese is a journalist, a freelance reporter, the author of numerous wonderful books, including The Iran Agenda, Target Iraq, Dateline Havana, Conversations with Terrorists. He was a writer and editor for Ramparts from 1963 to 1975. His work now appears on NPR and the CBC and ABC Australia, in the San Francisco Chronicle, the Christian Science Monitor. His documentaries are on PBS, for one of which he's won a Peabody Award. And he is here to talk about current events in what we call the Middle East, in particular Bahrain and Syria. Reese Ehrlich, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be on.
Let's talk about Bahrain first, because it seems to me considerably less in the U.S. So-called mainstream news. Am I right about that?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, a lot of folks don't even know where Bahrain is. It's an island nation off the coast of Saudi Arabia, not far from Iran across the Gulf. And it's a critical country for the U.S. because the U.S. Naval Fleet, the Fifth Navy Fleet, is stationed there, headquartered there, and the country's oil supplies are critical for Europe and other U.S. allies.
And what has been happening in Bahrain of late in terms of the Arab Spring?
Sure. Back at the very beginning of the Arab Spring in February of 2011, the people of Bahrain rose up against their monarchy. There's not even the pretense of a parliamentary democracy in Bahrain. It's a monarchy run by the same family for hundreds of years. They've had the same prime minister for 42 years. The people rose up. There's only about 1.25 million people in Bahrain, and over 100,000 came out to demonstrate. So do the math. What would 10% of the American population be out in the streets? What would that look like? And it was brutally repressed. The Saudi government sent in troops to back up the monarchy, as did some other Gulf Cooperation Council countries. And as far as the U.S. was concerned and the U.S. media, the uprising was crushed. But in fact, it continued on a kind of smolder. And just recently, in the last few weeks, there's been a flare-up once again. The anger against the government was always there, and now tens of thousands of people are back in the streets demonstrating.
And what is the position of the United States? I believe there is a former U.S. police chief over there helping to lead the crackdown on the...
They have two-faced policies. On the one hand, officially, the U.S. is critical of the human rights violations by the government in Bahrain. It's urging democratic reform. It's urging moderation on the opposition and dialogue between the two sides. That's the official State Department position. In reality, the U.S. has backed the monarchy, including providing arms, signing a new arms agreement, sending, as you mentioned, so-called aid, people to help out, to advise the military and the police. No denunciation of the foreign troops that are permanently stationed in Bahrain now. Imagine if Iran had permanently stationed troops in Syria as a result of claiming that they have the right to defend their ally. The outrage in Washington and parts of Europe over that, but that's in fact what the Saudis have now done in Bahrain. So the U.S. has a two-phase policy because U.S. Oil, the Bahrain oil benefits the U.S. and its allies, and the naval fleet being based there benefits the U.S., so suddenly you have a different attitude towards human rights.
I met some activists from Bahrain, including attorneys in Washington, who talked about people murdered, people beaten up, people put in prison for speech, and people and lawyers put in prison for daring to defend the defendants of these outrageous charges from the government. I mean, it seems like gross abuses of human rights that a government that was supposed to care about human rights would be loudly denouncing and working to bring pressure against.
Yes, again, if these activities were going on in Syria, the U.S. would be denouncing from the skies the human rights violations. It was just January 7th that the courts in Bahrain upheld the illegal conviction of 13 leaders of the opposition who had been jailed by a military tribunal, basically for either speaking out against the government or participating in peaceful demonstrations. That was a crime. Some were sentenced to life in prison. Some one of them went on a hunger strike for 3 months. But the civilian courts upheld the decision of the military courts. We'll see if there's a further appeals, but so far, the government is cracking down, and it's a complete violation of norms that, at least allegedly, the United States supports in other countries.
And is there a grander purpose that might justify such tolerance for abuse? Is the Fifth Fleet being stationed there serving some humanitarian goal, or is
the humanitarian goal of protecting the profits of U.S. oil companies?
Of course,
Let's keep our human rights perspectives straight. The U.S., the Fifth Fleet's been there for a long time, and the ostensible reason is to maintain stability in the region, protect sea lanes. Of course, the Fifth Fleet was used in the attack on Iraq in the first Gulf War. It was used in the attack on Iraq during the 2003 invasion. It was used in the war in Afghanistan. That's an example of the kind of human rights that the Navy helps protect.
And the friendship with Saudi Arabia, I assume, would fall to a similar characterization.
Yes, Saudi Arabia plays a critical role internationally, both because of its large oil reserves and also at least its perceived ability to control or seriously impact oil prices because of its huge reserves. And the monarchy in Saudi Arabia has ruled for many years. They've been pro-U.S., and so therefore there's always muted criticisms of human rights violations in Saudi Arabia.
If the U.S. government were serious and unified in its support for human rights in Bahrain, what actions would it be taking that it's not taking now?
Well, I asked that question to the opposition, and what they said, nobody's asking for, like, a military invasion or anything like that. In fact, they're quite upset with U.S. military actions in other parts of the Middle East. What they say is that there should be strong criticism of the government. They should support the establishment of a U.N. human rights office in Manama, the capital of Bahrain. They should talk about cutting off arms supplies, if need be, sanctions against the leadership in Bahrain. With those kind of, you know, given the dependence of the Bahrain government on support from the United States, those kind of efforts would both politically and economically make a significant dent in the government policies there. They'd either have to make significant reforms or you'd have to change the system and set up a real parliamentary system. So the U.S., in the case of its allies, it really does have a lot of ability to pressure the existing governments.
Indeed. In the case of Syria, from all angles, it's a different picture. What's happening in Syria?
Well, Syria, again, with its uprising, a genuine popular uprising that began in February of 2011, the uprising there, think of it as like the Occupy movement that took place in New York or Oakland or various parts of the U.S., where a spontaneous uprising with thousands of people, many of them young activists, getting involved for the first time, except if you take the Occupy Wall Street, let's say, and then suddenly 30,000 Christian evangelicals have showed up and saying, we're against the 1%. We're in favor of the 99%, and we're going to stay in Zuccotti Park until we win our demands. And you go, whoa, these are interesting new allies. And what do you think about women and women's rights? And what do you think about abortion rights? And what do you think about gay rights? And you get a rough idea of what it's like in Syria and the other Arab Spring countries, where you have people both against the existing system, against the U.S. empire, and with very conservative views on a lot of other topics, including social issues. And that's the mix that you've got in Syria today. So the Muslim Brotherhood is the main opposition group, which is, I call it, a center-right Islamist perspective, but they are committed to having a parliamentary system, which means free elections, the right for unions to organize, the right for press freedoms, hold rallies and freedom of speech, et cetera, et cetera. If Syria were able to get that kind of a system going, it would be a tremendous step forward compared to the dictatorship that they have now. Unfortunately, there's also more extremist, ultra-rightist Islamist forces, some of whom have come from Iraq and other places, who are vying for control, and they are getting funded by arms from Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And for the moment, because they've got the guns and they've won some battles, they have more influence. I don't think if there were the fighting ended tomorrow and they were somehow able to have free and fair elections, those extremist forces would not have that much popular support. But as long as the Assad government continues its repression, it is, after all, firing missiles and dropping bombs on its own civilian population. Nobody is going to be able to support Assad, and the question remains who's going to come out on top once the fighting ends.
During the Cold War, notably, and in at least some quarters now, regrettably, the United States government chose to back right-wing religious forces as an alternative to dictatorships that were no longer acceptable or legitimate populist or leftist movements that might be deemed too friendly to the Soviet Union. Is that still the case? Does the United States government...
You gotta go country by... I know exactly what you're talking about. A good example would be Afghanistan during the time of the Soviet occupation. The U.S. backed the most reactionary Islamist forces there, the Mujahideen, which led to chaos and civil war after the Soviet Union pulled out. There's no question that at that time, in those circumstances, the U.S. preferred ultra-right-wing Islamist governments to anything that might be critical of the U.S. Times have changed, though, and you know, groups like Al-Qaeda and others are genuinely anti-U.S. as well as being reactionary and using Islam as an excuse to impose their power on a given country. So that's the problem the U.S. faces in Syria, which is that it would prefer to find a pro-U.S. strongman, preferably a secularist. If not, then some kind of a so-called moderate Islamist. But they haven't been able to find one. And that's one of the reasons the Obama administration has not intervened in a more muscular fashion. The U.S. has been providing arms or okaying the providing of arms, but they haven't set up a no-fly zone. They haven't actually committed American troops because they don't have somebody that they trust to put in power after the show is over. And that's part of the contradiction. That's why the U.S. lost the war in Iraq. It lost the war in Afghanistan. It's losing another war in Pakistan and not doing so well in Syria. So despite the bluster coming out of Washington, the U.S. is in a big pickle.
If the U.S. government, again, similar question to Bahrain, if the U.S. government had a unified, consistent, honest position in favor of nonviolent change and the development of stable democratic societies, would there be a different course it would be taking in Syria?
Yeah, well, if there, all those things were true, you probably wouldn't. You could celebrate things on your radio show, right?
Indeed.
Yeah. Yes. The situation in Syria is complicated. Even I don't know. Somehow, if the U.S. didn't exist as a country and was not meddling in the affairs of Syria, the other neighboring countries would meddle. Iran, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, they're all doing that. The U.S., of course, is the big guy on the block, so it has, at least as far as its allies are concerned, the final say. But these other countries have their own interests and are lining up with different opposition forces. The Turks, for example, are backing the Muslim Brotherhood. Saudi Arabia is backing the more extremist, ultra-right-wing Islamist forces, and so on. And the U.S. is impacted by those things. If the U.S. had a consistent non-interventionist policy, it could not only not get involved itself in arming people, for example, it could tell its allies not to either. And the people of Syria would have a much better time sorting out who they want to run their country. It wouldn't be easy, but it would be a lot less complicated and a lot less forces involved than it is now.
And perhaps Russia, too, would be among the countries that could be influenced to stop arms shipments?
Yeah. I mean, the Russian, and to some extent China, is the boogeyman in this situation. The U.S. can never acknowledge that its policies are causing problems or that it can't affect things. So it's got to find somebody, some big power on the outside. So it's Iran or it's Russia or it's China. I mean, Russia has historically allied with Syria. Yes, they give them political support. They give them arms, but they give them a lot, the Assad government, a lot less arms than the U.S. and its allies are providing to the opposition. So, I think the Russians seem to have shifted from solid support to Assad to trying to find an exit strategy. And I think the Iranians are going to do the same, because I think pretty much everybody realizes now Assad's not going to stay in power for a whole lot longer.
There are reports from nearly a decade ago from Wesley Clark and from the then Prime Minister of the United Kingdom of lists in the Pentagon of nations whose governments should be overthrown, with Syria on the list. This dates back to a period when there was no serious revolt in the news. The Syrian government was dutifully torturing people on behalf of the United States government, and yet Syria was on a list of governments that need to be changed. What shapes that agenda, and is it still the same agenda?
Well, the U.S. has had an interesting relationship with Syria. If you go back to the 1960s, 70s, Syria was the big enemy because it opposed Israel. Remember, it got involved. It was involved in the 67 war. Israel took Golan, which was part of the Syrian territory, and annexed it. And Syria never went along with that, and at least in terms of lip service, supported the Palestinian cause against Israel. So they were a bête noire. Syria were the bad guys. And the fact that they were a dictatorship made it an easier case to make them the bad guys. Of course, the U.S. supports plenty of other dictatorships around the Middle East, but that's another question. So, but then the Cold War ends and the Soviet Union collapses, and suddenly, and people tend to forget this, Hafez al-Assad, the father of the current president, sided with the U.S. in the first Gulf War because they hated Iran. I'm sorry, they hated Iraq, and they allied with Iran. So the Syrians actually sent members of their army to support the so-called Allied invasion of Iraq in 1991. They were U.S. allies. Later, the Syrian government engaged in serious negotiations with Israel to possibly return the Golan. They agreed to a two-state solution with Israel. So they were not, apparently, at those times, they were not such bad guys. They were perhaps not the bete noirs that had been previously set. And then Bashar al-Assad, the current president, started a series of economic reforms which followed the precepts of the IMF and the World Bank, neoliberal reforms, privatizing state-run industries. Of course, he privatized it to his cronies, to his relatives, and now you have a crony capitalist as opposed to a state capitalist system in Syria. So the U.S. is perfectly willing to go along with these dictatorships when it's perceived in Washington that Washington is getting something out of it. At the same time, they would prefer to have a pro-U.S. dictatorship there rather than a dictatorship that's critical of the U.S., and I think that's what we're seeing now. But the fact that the U.S. wants to have a pro-U.S. strongman there doesn't mean it's going to get it. Look at Egypt. Look at some of the other countries in the region. It's up for grabs as to who's going to win the Arab Spring uprising, and it's by no means sure the U.S. is going to come out on top.
Well, clearly the revolution in Egypt has not yet been everything that demonstrators in Tahrir Square 2 years ago
absolutely
wanted.
Clearly. It's a big battle.
What is...
again, go think back at the Occupy movement if you had the evangelicals on your side. And then once you...
Right.
And then you won power in New York. Who's going to rule? That's what the problem the Egyptians face. And the Islamists have tremendous popular support. There's no question about it.
And what is the relationship now of the U.S. government to those in power in Egypt?
In Egypt? Well, the U.S. always has a plan A, a plan B, and a plan C, and so on down the line. So plan A was for the military to take over from Mubarak and run the show much as Mubarak had. That didn't work. The military got isolated politically. Plan B was to work with the Muslim Brotherhood to see that they were pro-U.S. And by that I mean, first of all, they have to adopt U.S.-style neoliberal economic policies in terms of trade and privatization, et cetera, et cetera. They have to remain, if not friendly with Israel, at least not antagonistic, and they can't be too openly supportive of the Palestinians. Well, the current government opened up the border with Gaza, which has made a tremendous difference in terms of loosening, shall I say, the blockade on Gaza. They cut off the natural gas supplies to Israel, which was under a deal negotiated with Mubarak, and generally haven't been acting as pro-Israel as the U.S. would want. Yet neither have they taken any decisive steps against the U.S. So the U.S. is still hoping to negotiate, and they're not happy with the Muslim Brotherhood, but they're hoping to negotiate with them. And this, for the forces that they did support, there were some secular, wealthy people who ran in the elections and so on. They didn't do so well in the elections, the pro-U.S. Presidential candidates and so on. So the U.S. is in a quandary. It's trying to find the guy or the set of political forces, and it's still working with the military, who have tremendous power. And it's an ongoing battle. So the people who were in Tahrir Square calling for a secular parliamentary system are still out there fighting hard. And the Islamist forces are doing battle, and the military is there too. So it's unclear who's going to end up on top.
In the minutes we have left, we're speaking with Rhys Ehrlich, author, journalist, freelance producer, and you can find him at rhysehrlich.com. Rhys, I think it was in 2005 or so you went to Iran with my friend Norman Solomon and with the actor Sean Penn, and you wrote about that and other trips to Iran in your wonderful book, The Iran Agenda, talking about the threat of war from our country back in 2007 or so. It seems to be still alive, does it not, this threat of an attack on Iran?
Well, you have to remember, starting in about somewhere in the mid-1980s, Iran was about to have a nuclear bomb and was going to kill all the Israelis, and they've been threatening to do so every 2-3 years since then. It's really hilarious to go back at the statements both out of Washington and Jerusalem to hear the threat of Iran's nuclear weapons and how dire it was going to be, because practically any day now they're going to have a nuclear weapon to kill the people of Israel and attack U.S. interests in the area, et cetera, et cetera. And somehow or another it hasn't happened. The U.S. exaggerates the danger from Iran. It doesn't have a nuclear weapon. There's no indications they're trying to develop one. The sanctions imposed on Iran are far worse than anything that the Bush administration had done, and it's hurting the people of Iran. I met a movie director who's critical of the government, and basically the movie industry has shut down in Iran these days, partly because of reactionary policies of the government and partly because of the lack of money. The banking sanctions and so on have hurt not just the elite who run the country, but ordinary Iranians. And the U.S. very cynically knows that these kind of sanctions hurt ordinary people, but they try to officially say they don't. And what they hope is that the economic pressure on ordinary people will force them to get rid of their government. But they haven't been able to actually point to any examples where that's taken place. So, yes, many of the issues that I raised in my book and saw on my previous trips exist today.
Doesn't the reverse tend to happen? Doesn't the external threat lead to a rallying around the current government?
Yeah, the U.S., the Iranian government says, there's high inflation, there's unemployment, which, by the way, were problems even before the sanctions, but we can blame it all on the U.S. And to some extent, that's true, and people tend to rally around their government. There have been no examples where these kinds of sanctions have actually resulted in the overthrow of a government and the installing of a better one. The example that's sometimes used is South Africa, but that was an international boycott combined with a domestic insurrection and armed struggle that got rid of apartheid. It was not the kind of sanctions that the U.S. has been using in Syria or Iran or other places.
We're almost out of time. Quickly, your thoughts on cabinet nominees and whether there's any serious difference if someone like Chuck Hagel is made Secretary of so-called Defense.
I mean, it is funny to see Republicans getting all bent out of shape out of a fellow Republican getting nominated. You know, I mean, they can't even accept a bipartisan offer. This is inside the Beltway minutia, frankly. I don't think, we had Gates as Secretary of Defense, and it doesn't really matter. The Obama administration has a policy of human rights intervention, military intervention, whereas Bush had a policy of, oil intervention. But as far as the people affected by these interventions, it's the same result. So I don't think it makes ultimately a lot of difference whether Chuck Hagel or who gets appointed to these positions. So Obama is going to make the final decision, and he's clearly decided on a right-of-center interventionist foreign policy.
Sad but important wisdom. We've been speaking with Reese Ehrlich. You can find him at reeseehrlich.com. You should get his books and read his articles. I will link to everything from davidswanson.org/talknationradio. Reese, thanks very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Always a pleasure.
The inauguration is over and the honeymoon should be too. Go to rootsaction.org for the fastest, easiest way to get involved. Go to warisacrime.org to learn more, including what you can do about a president who gives a speech on the unalienable right to life while simultaneously murdering people in Yemen with a killer flying robot. Enough is enough. There is such a thing as being too late. Get active now. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. All past shows can be found at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. Until next time.